Okay, welcome back from the fabulous break. You all know the drill by now, don't you? Stay to the allotted time. You have the responsibility for that, and then for all the rest of you. Yeah. No, write down some really nasty questions. Let's see get the temperature up and running. This session is on digital technology enabling open citizen collaborative and crowd-funded science. And to moderate this session, we have the head of the OECD Global Science Forum, Cartage Smith. Welcome.
No.
Yeah. Okay. So we'll carry on from where we've got up to now. I think it's quite a challenge for the speakers in this session. They were talking about having to follow the great acts, the great speeches and presentations that came before them.
Mm-hmm.
We'll move on also picking up on some of the topics that have come up a little bit in the previous sessions. So this session is focusing around open science. So we've covered funding, we've covered data issues, we've covered AI itself, blockchain itself. One of the areas that doesn't necessarily get a lot of attention but is actually very important in thinking around open science is the broader citizen engagement, opening up science beyond the science community, engaging citizens. We've heard a little bit about that, as I say, and we'll go into that more in this session. It raises a lot of new policy issues, and some of them have been already arisen, and we can follow up on those further. It's also interesting in this session that this is actually an all-lady session, except for myself. I think it's the first all-lady session. Not old, all, not old, no. Which it's the Liverpool accent. So anyway, the first of our ladies is Linda Carl, Senior Counselor, Director of Ownership and Innovation at the BioBricks Foundation.
Okay. Thank you, Carthage. And I'd like to thank Oslo Met and OECD for inviting me here, and for all of you for your participation in this workshop. It's been incredibly exciting and enlightening for me to hear all of you. I'm going to switch the topic a little bit away from computer science and into biotechnology. And I'm specifically going to be describing some of the legal and digital frameworks surrounding open access to research tools. And so a little bit of background. Open access has traditionally been captured in the context of publications, where a typical definition would say it means free access to information and unrestricted use to electronic resources for everyone. That's a UNESCO definition. But many of them have the same feel, where there's basically two elements to open access. One is that it means free access to information and unrestricted use. Those are two separate things. So how does that play out? Well, free access is typically achieved by removing price barriers. And this, in the case of publications, would be things like subscriptions, licensing fees, pay-per-views, things that the reader might experience. Unrestricted use, on the other hand, is achieved by removing permission barriers. And this would be, in the case of publications, mostly copyright. And the way that this plays out is free access is actually, it's free for the readers, but it's not free for the producers. So it doesn't mean free of cost somewhere. If this was not economically feasible in the age of print, and it has become economically sustainable today because the amounts of money that we were putting into print subscriptions before was far more than we could put into an open access electronic-based system. And with regards to unrestricted use, we remove permission barriers. And it's important to keep in mind that open access is not a license to disregard the law. It's actually trying to achieve lawful sharing. And to do this, you need, in the case of copyrighted works, you need the consent of the copyright holder. This can be through things such as the Creative Commons licenses. Or in some cases, material has fallen into the public domain, either because it was created by a government agency, for example, and directly placed in the public domain, or the copyright has expired. But what does open access mean in the context of research tools? And specifically, is it economically feasible, particularly in biotech tools, to remove the price barriers for free access to these? And what about the permission barriers? Is it legally feasible to remove those for research tools? In the case of price barriers, you have to keep in mind that research tools are tangible materials, things that scientists touch, that they put in test tubes, that they look at under microscopes, that they conduct their experiments with. They're tangible materials, and there are costs incurred for collecting, curating, storing, and shipping these materials. On the legal side, it's not as simple as copyright. There are a lot of rights that can read on research tools, among which are patent protection of the tools themselves or for particular uses of the tools. There's also access and benefit sharing when you're talking about genetic resources in various countries, biosecurity concerns, and also customs regulations. So just as a brief overview of some of the legal frameworks that have been developed for sharing research tools, typically, a tool is considered a material, and it might be exchanged under a material transfer agreement. Back in 1995, the National Institutes of Health tried to create a standard transfer agreement for that they called the Uniform Biological Material Transfer Agreement. The idea was to have a standard that everyone could agree with and reduce some of the transaction costs around negotiations. That gave some limited access to research tools, generally only academics only, and some limited use because, of course, they didn't deal with third-party rights. About 10 years later, there was an initiative out of Cambia called the BIOS licenses. And this was an all-encompassing framework where they developed the research tools, they would deliver the research tools, they patented them, they had a framework for licensing that was basically based on mutual non-assertion because they wanted to instigate open science. And they had material transfer agreements that were coordinated with all this. So they addressed access, they addressed use, and it was a monumental failure. And the reason was that they didn't get participation. You know, people would be glad to accept the open access tool, but they weren't willing to invest in additional patent protection that they would then make available to others under the similar terms. It just economically didn't work, culturally didn't work. A few years after that, the BioBricks Foundation came out with the BioBrick Public Agreement, where they had the time to benefit from the lessons learned with the Cambia BIOS licenses. And basically, the agreement is it's an online promise by the contributor to not assert the rights that they have against a particular genetic resource that they might have developed in exchange for a promise by the user to use those genetic resources responsibly and give credit. The challenge there was it's an online promise. There actually wasn't any material associated with these promises that we had online. And so they didn't really address the problem of access. And again, the problem of use was very limited because it didn't address third-party rights. And there was no requirement for the contributor to even check to see if there might have already been a right reading on the genetic resource. So recently, we've developed, in collaboration with a number of others, the Open Material Transfer Agreement. And this was a much more modest proposal. It was specifically focused on access to research tools under conditions where the transfer agreement itself would not impose additional barriers. And I'll talk a little bit more about that later. So it specifically was addressing access to actual research materials, and again, very limited ability to deal with use. The recipients have to conduct their own due diligence, for example. The digital frameworks that exist have to do with bringing transparency to ownership so one could check for all of these third-party rights. There's eSpaceNet, very, very powerful database. It includes all of the patent documents from WIPO. As an example, the USPTO also has an electronic database that's publicly open. It's only restricted to US patents. One of the best resources is lens.org. It's a repository that's run by Cambia also. This is what they did after the BIAS licenses. And it hosts over 100 million patent and also scholarly documents from 95 different jurisdictions. And all of these only deal with the question of permission barriers. They don't provide access to materials. But this is what we have to work with. So how do these frameworks play out in the real world? They have to be integrated with by someone. And I'd like to give you three examples. One of them is the International Genetically Engineered Machine Competition. This was a student competition that was first held at MIT in 2004 with, I think, three or five teams from the United States. It has since grown to this year. They had over 300 teams from over 400 countries. And in this, it's a biotechnology-based student competition for high school, undergraduate, and also graduate divisions. And they have this registry of standardized biological parts, which they distribute to all of the teams every year. And the idea is that you use these parts to create a biological system that answers some societal need. And in the course of doing that, you improve the parts or you create new parts, and you give them back to the registry. They don't deal with MTAs at all. It's all under a policy of you get what everybody gets, and you give back at the end, and then over time the collection increases and becomes better for everyone. A second example is AdGene. This is a nonprofit repository also founded in the early 2000s. And today they have now shipped more than 1,000 or more than 1 million plasmids to thousands of labs all across the world. Their genius for doing this was to come up with an electronic material transfer agreement. And this was new at the time, and it's still relatively new to the culture of the tech transfer world, which prefers fax machines and letters that get sent and papers that get carried over. So the electronic system for processing MTAs was and still is a big advance. When they set up their system, the Uniform Biological Material Transfer Agreement was the standard that they adopted, which basically locked in restrictions for all plasmids that are not necessarily appropriate for those plasmids, because they're not all subject to third-party rights. They're not all subject to patent protection. There's no reason to limit to academic institutions. But yet, because that was the legal framework they were working with at the time, they're kind of locked into that. They will be distributing under the Open MTA starting in 2019. Just to give you a feel for some of the features of the Open MTA, it was designed with these attributes of openness in mind, and I encourage you to go to openmta.org. You'll find a link to the publication that just came out about this, as well as a lot of helpful videos, and I encourage you to sign on to the Open Material Transfer Agreement. It's a really awesome thing. And then finally, the third example is something from the BioBricks Foundation itself. It's the Free Genes Project. It's a program that we're running where the goal is to synthesize 10,000 genes and distribute them to anyone in the entire world that requests them. And the requests themselves are crowdsourced. We're not going to try to figure out what's useful to the biotech research community. They can communicate with us what they think is useful for them and their colleagues. And the idea is that these materials will be distributed under the Open Material Transfer Agreement, which allows for commercial use, and it also allows for redistribution. So it's a way of getting research tools into the hands of many that would be generally useful. So that comes back to the same two questions. Is it economically feasible to remove price barriers for distribution, open access to research tools? And is it legally feasible to remove the permission barriers for these tools? So let's look at them. Well, let's see. The material costs are being underwritten by the BioBricks Foundation through a grant that we received from the Helmsley Charitable Trust. So same as publications, it's not free. It might be free to the users, but it's not free to produce. The shipping costs are being reduced because we're working in partnership with AdGene, and they've already spent a lot of time figuring out how to get through customs and shipping to different countries. Some of the questions we have to address with regard to permission barriers, the biosecurity searches. We want to make sure that the sequences that we're synthesizing are not things that shouldn't be sent to random people across the world. We want to make sure that they pass biosecurity checks. This is being done by Twist Biosciences, which is the DNA synthesis partner that we're working with on this project. The patent searches are done using the database provided by lens.org. As I mentioned, they have patent data from 95 different jurisdictions. They've also created a lot of very powerful tools to do some of the third-party rights searches based on DNA sequence or protein sequence, as well as keywords and ownership. And then finally, a lot of the patent searches are being done through a partnership with Sagacious IP that are physically conducting the patent searches on the Lens database. And so what I'd like you to see from here is that, yes, it's possible to create open access or a form of open access with research tools, but it takes a village, and it takes a lot of infrastructure and a lot of coordination. And we need policies in place to promote this sort of nonprofit building of the infrastructure for biotechnology. And with that, I shall say thank you.
Thanks very much, Linda. So now we've got the tools available. Let's move on to Jan Uti, who's a Georgia Institute of Technology. And Jan will talk more about team science, so using these tools amongst different groups of scientists.
Thank you. So thank you to OECD and Oslo Met. When Alistair Nolan contacted me about this, I was a little bit scratching my head because research collaboration and IT almost seems like an oxymoron to me. That's kind of the theme of my talk, and here's why is going to be my presentation. So we know that research collaboration has increased. This study of Web of Science data over the last several decades tells us now that 9 out of every 10 papers have 2 or more authors, and if you take out math, it's going to even be higher. Not only that, 1 out of 4 articles have an international collaborator. And then there's this issue of hyper-authorship, which Blaise Cronin at Indiana University coined in the early 1990s. Those are papers with 100 or more authors. Back when Blaise Cronin coined this, the top paper had a few hundred authors. Now the top paper has more than 3,000 authors. So how do you manage this situation? Actually, Alistair did contact me because we did a national study of research collaboration. We talked to 640 professors, sent them a survey. We did personal interviews with 60 faculty, and we had anonymous blog posts that had 200 blog posts. And when asking them, what helps you manage these collaborations, only a quarter of them mentioned IT. And you can see they went to some really sophisticated IT, like the phone, video conferencing, Skype, basically anything that's free, email, some file storage. One person mentioned the archive. So there's not a lot of sophisticated use of IT in this space of managing research collaboration. And I do want to mention that there's a whole group in the U.S. coming out of the National Institutes of Health called the Science of Team Science, and they're putting up a lot of online toolkits to help with managing these big teams. My view about this is it reminds me of when I was a teenager and I would take quizzes in the magazines with my girlfriends and we would giggle and laugh because they're a little simplistic. I mean, the challenges are really complicated as far as managing teams. And of course, what I've heard today is that's no problem for probably any of the systems that you're working on. But we did find that the best scholars did have explicit communications. They did deal with these people issues. But only 40% of the people we interviewed had explicit we surveyed had explicit discussions, and only 30% of those had them at the beginning of a paper or a project. So mostly scholars kind of don't want to do this. Of course, a lot of people work with the same people over and over, so they don't need to have explicit discussions. But having this kind of communication, dealing with the trust issues, and then especially dealing with differences in power and rank is really important. And also, science changes, so you need to kind of update your plan. You can't just make a plan at the beginning and leave it. So I'm going to shift to, now I'm going to move to kind of the second part of, this is kind of what Alistair wanted me to talk about. Now I'm going to shift to some new research I'm working on, which I think is really exciting. It's a little bit about how IT makes collaboration much worse. And I'm going to start with, this is where Johan, I am with you there. He had, we're kind of on the same page with the rise in regulation and how it leads to greater compliance burden. And most of the policy discussion about this has been at the national level. You know, how can we smooth all the requirements we need? How can we reduce the proposal burden? Because as Johan mentioned, there is a rise in proposals. But the work I'm working on more has to deal with the university level, because a lot of these regulations are really vague and universities don't know what to do, but they don't want to get into trouble, so they over-comply, and their burden is increasing. So that takes me to Anna's comment, kind of revising or revisiting this quip from Solo. And I really don't care if IT is in the productivity statistics, but what I care about is productive for whom? And I think my argument is that IT systems, at least that universities are implementing to deal with this increasing burden, are shifting the burden, just like the self-service movement has done, from the providers to the scholars. So from the administrators to the faculty who actually do the research. So this research involves a little bit of navel gazing, what we call robotic email systems. These are automated compliance systems that universities have implemented to deal with this rise in proposals and regulation. And the systems include a component where they send out automated emails every time there's an activity. And you can tell that they're automated because they have these usual automated addresses. Mostly do not reply, so you can't send back anything. I don't understand this. So my colleague and I are analyzing our emails from, this is a little bit of navel gazing, but from the last several projects. And one thing we've found is the use of robotic systems varies quite a bit between our two universities. At my university at Georgia Tech, the IT system, I mean the proposal and grants administration system is very centralized. So I find that 2/3 of my emails are either they're either robotic emails or responses to robotic emails. In my colleague's case, only about 1 in 5 emails are robotic emails or responses to robotic emails. In part, that's because he's a public administration expert and he likes to argue about everything, so he has a lot of manual interchange. But I just kind of like to not spend too much time on this, get it done. But I did another kind of analysis we did off of this work is to look at chained emails. So those are when you get a robotic email, do you have to respond? And then, you know, how many other emails does that lead to? And I found that all but 2 of my emails were chained emails, meaning that I had to spend a lot of time sending out emails to get things resolved. My conclusion here is the last thing about these emails is it's very easy to add recipients. So one of my emails had 136 recipients. So you're kind of, it's easy to place the burden on ever more people to respond to these compliance requests at the university level. Mostly, we find that robotic bureaucracy, these kind of automated emails, are useful for automated tasks, and they do help with kind of filling out the forms you need to fill out. But they're pretty much all throughout my work, except for the work I do with my colleagues on a project. So anything involving the Institutional Review Board, conflict of interest, budgeting, all of that. So these kind of robotic systems increasingly go out to throughout the tasks of a researcher. And I'm never asked if I think this system is making my life better. We don't know if these kinds of systems are making the administrators' lives easier. Are they more productive? I don't know. I think not, but then why would they implement the systems? But I know they don't make my life easier. So my conclusion is that, you know, just this, that it's possible that the systems save time for administrators. Probably a next step would be survey administrators or interview administrators. But I know they don't make my life easier, and I know I haven't been part of the process, and I don't think they make research collaboration easier. So thank you.
Thank you very much, Jan. I'm looking at Alistair. I'm not sure. He seems to be smiling after that second part of the presentation. So, but I think that's a reality that we all face, a very practical reality. How do we deal with emails, the information overload, et cetera, and where does AI fit in with that? So moving on from the tools and the teams, Leah Shanley is now going to talk to us more about citizen science, so expanding science beyond the science community itself. Leah is from the University of North Carolina in Chapel Hill.
Oh, thank you. And I, too, would like to thank the OECD and Oslo Met for being here. The OECD very wisely published a report on open science in which they included citizen science as one of the core components. In the U.S., we were also coming to that conclusion when we hosted an event at the White House and strategically called it Open Science and Innovation with Citizen Science. In the U.S. federal government, we spent more than 6 months trying to define what is citizen science. And with like any academic, you want to name something. So there had been the traditional definition, both by Alan Irwin and Rick Bonney in the U.S. The two definitions didn't necessarily align, and it was strictly focused on science and over time had become synonymous with education or informal learning. So we developed a definition, and I've highlighted some of the words that were very particular. Contributions of the public. Some of the science directors in the federal agency said, what do you mean participation? They're actually making concrete, proactive contributions to science. Not just scientific research, but also engineering research. Our National Science Foundation said, hey, our engineering division want to include citizen scientists as well. And monitoring, so not just fundamental research, but also, say, environmental monitoring or more operational needs. So our agencies like the Environmental Protection Agency and the Federal Communications Commissions wanted to use citizen science and crowdsourced approach to meet their missions. So not just data collecting, but also participating in the full range of the scientific process. So I think that diagram kind of lays out for you that spectrum in which citizens might contribute anywhere from, yes, data collection, but all the way to problem solving. That said, we're beginning to see an evolution in citizen science that includes gaming, active problem solving like the Citizen Science Project Foldit, machine learning and computer vision and data analysis, and even model building. So for example, a couple of great examples. In my hub, we fund what they call a spoke project in big data and AI for environmental sustainability. It's using the Encyclopedia of Life project to layer model building on top of it to help citizen science understand the database they're helping to create. It lays on top IBM Watson to allow citizen science to and others to query the database. Projects like Wildbook and Stall Catchers are using AI and citizen scientists combined in their efforts. Another emergent trend is the combination of citizen science with satellite Earth observation data, and a project by colleagues at UNC Chapel Hill, where I am, funded by NASA, are using citizen scientists globally to measure lake depths and then combining it with satellite information for the area of the lakes and looking at water availability changes. So why would we consider citizen science? Well, it helps us solve a scientific or engineering problem. It can improve our spatial or temporal resolution, increase our geographic extent of the data. So if we can only hire 5 grad students, but 100 volunteers or 33,000 volunteers want to help out, that extends our collection area. They can help us analyze imagery, and sometimes the eye is better than the algorithm. Help to generate new data applications and technologies, so mobile apps, the maker movement is now beginning to merge with citizen science in some areas, and of course STEM or hands-on learning. And some of our colleagues at State Department said, hey, we want to use this to improve science diplomacy. That said, citizen science isn't always appropriate for every task, and you must still design it well and worry about data quality, as with any scientific project. There's a growing body of literature looking at the return on investment in citizen science. There's an international collaboration called GeoValue that's looking at the value of Earth observation data, geographic information data, and so forth. So there have been a couple of studies, particularly in the biodiversity space, that indicate the in-kind contributions of volunteers can be quite significant, talking tens of millions of dollars. That said, I found at least 2 studies in recent years that are saying, well, if we do a full cost accounting and account for the amount of training and the handholding and the engagement we have to put in, then it may or may not be as cost effective as we were hoping. So again, these need to be considered. I have a colleague, Dr. Andrea Wiggins, who said citizen science is free like a puppy. Right, so it's wonderful and exciting, but you have to spend a lot of time engaging it. The worries. Well, when I was in the federal government, there were a handful of us doing citizen science or interested in citizen science. The NSF had been funding this in informal learning for quite some time. A couple of agencies were at the forefront, like the U.S. Geological Survey and NASA. But a lot of the other agencies, like the Environmental Protection Agency, said, well, we're interested, but what about data quality? What about data quality? What about data quality? First question out of everybody's mouth. Then they'd ask things like, what about the Paperwork Reduction Act, which in the U.S. government, anybody's required to get an approval through that process in order to be able to poll more than 10 people, right? That process is incredibly onerous and can take more than a year and often would stifle innovative projects. Legal and ethical issues are huge. Privacy, liability, intellectual property, review board, right? Those are all big issues in the federal government and elsewhere. We haven't even begun to think about the procurement regulations for citizen science. Cybersecurity is another topic that hasn't really percolated to the top, but I think now with misinformation, we do need to be paying attention to that. Issues of cyber infrastructure, there are a lot of little pots of data. How do we connect that? So, for example, in the U.S., we have 1,700 volunteer water monitoring groups, all operating with different protocols and standards, all with little pots of data. How do we begin to think about creating some commonality or interoperability across these systems and storing them in a place that all can access and aggregate it up nationally? So to begin to tackle some of those issues, I was at the running the Commons Lab at the Wilson Center, I funded a series of 19 studies that did an in-depth analysis of a lot of these legal and policy issues in the context of the U.S. I also funded Mukhi Hockley, who is, I can think, the one who's responsible for me being here, to look at some of these issues in Europe. And one of the big things that people coming new to citizen science is, well, how do you get started? How do you design a project? How do you monitor engage volunteers and keep that engagement, sustain it? How do you manage data quality? And so we built a how-to toolkit as part of the President's Innovation Toolkit, or you might call it a guidebook. We also built a federal community of practice. So we started with 5 people in a box of cookies around a table. each within their own little silo at different agencies, and we began to connect them. And that five people became 10, became 20, became 100, jumped to 200. And by the end, right now, I think we're at 350 people across 60 agencies who are supporting this. We also work to get the heads of agencies. So John Holdren, the president's science advisor, we got him to come out publicly in support of citizen science. France Cordova, the head of the National Science Foundation, who used citizen science in her PhD dissertation to come out publicly in support of citizen science. And Dr. Rush Holt, former congressman and now the head of the American Association for the Advancement of Science. So hopefully bringing their weight, their credibility to bear on this. We developed a policy framework in the U.S. to support citizen science, so policy for citizen science. This included working with the White House to draft a memo that encouraged agencies to use citizen science and to lay out some basic guidelines for that use, and we can talk about that later if people are interested. And I happened to run into a legislative staffer in Senator Coon's office in a bar and pitched them, hey, citizen science is something pretty interesting, and here's all the challenges we face in the federal government, and they invited me to come to the office to brief them. And next I know, three months later, they said, hey, we're drafting legislation. Who else do we begin to talk to? And so now that legislation, people ask me, well, what does that do? Well, when I walked into NASA as a new staffer and said, hey, I want to do citizen science, they said, oh, you need to talk to the federal council. The NASA's chief counsel. I walked into his office and he said, no, you can't do citizen science unless it's explicitly authorized. It's explicitly authorized now. Then there's also citizen science to inform policy. And I think Europe has been farther along in this than the U.S. There is beginnings of a policy framework to support citizen science in Europe. Okay, I got 2 minutes. There's a white paper on citizen science that Societas put out, an open innovation, open science by the EU European Commission. There's a green paper in Germany, and Susan Heckler, who is a researcher in Germany, is going to be publishing soon a compilation of all the policy documents that are beginning to take place in Europe around citizen science. One of the exciting things I think that Europe is doing that we could learn from in the U.S. is the Citizen Science Observatories, which is an end-to-end from building the community of practice, providing the cyber infrastructure, to collaborating with the satellite remote sensing systems. We Observe now has got four different communities in this space, from interoperability to valuation. And lastly, we're seeing a trend of going from local projects to regional and national scale projects, like I mentioned this volunteer water monitoring in the U.S., to global scale. So the global mosquito challenge is one where we're now taking projects in which normally would have been individual citizen science projects and scaling them up globally. And in particular, the UN, CODATA, and a multinational working group are working to facilitate how citizen science might contribute to the SDGs. So that. Thank you.
Thanks very much. Okay, we move on now to crowdfunding, or back to crowdfunding. Chiara Franzoni should be joining us virtually, hopefully. There we are, digital technologies in practice.
Good morning, everybody, and thank you for inviting me. I'm excited to participate, even though just through the video. So the topic of my talk today, you should be able to see the presentation soon, is crowdfunding. So by crowdfunding of science, we mean the action of collecting money from the crowd, so fundraising from the crowd, that is done by scientists to fund their scientific projects. Since 2012, dozens of platforms were created to specifically raise funds for crowdfunding. These platforms resemble in the graphicals and design and the mode the very successful platforms like Kickstarter and Indiegogo that usually raise money for entrepreneurial and artistic projects. So we are interested in understanding whether this kind of fundraising can also work for scientists that aim at raising money for their own research. So similarly to traditional science funding, crowdfunding is project-based. So if I'm a scientist and I'm trying to collect money, I have to tell you precisely what do I plan on doing? How do I plan on using the money? And if I am convincing, then you give me the money and I tell you what budget do I need to do the project. And if I raise enough budget, then I'll do the project. And if I don't raise enough budget, then I'll simply give the money back and I will not do the project. So it is an all or nothing project. And this is similar to the classical funding of science, and it's project based. Okay. So the differences to the traditional science funding, however, are that in this case, there are not panels of scientists that choose which projects should get money. And instead, there are citizens that decide to pledge money to a specific project in science. And they are enabled by a digital media platform. And usually, on top of that, there is an open disclosure of logs from their labs that scientists use when they do their research. So to make it a little bit more concrete, I want to show you the most commonly used platform by scientists. It's called experiment.com. It is based in the US, and specifically their headquarters is in New York. And as you can see, there are a number of projects here which are open and listed for funding. So if I'm interested at this project here, I see that they're trying to raise $5,200. I can click through, see what do they propose. And I can bake this project by providing some amount of money. If within the target they meet the budget, then the money is cashed in. Otherwise, the project remains undone and the scientist doesn't cash in any money. Okay? So, we did some research on that because, of course, we wanted to understand how well is this model of fundraising working. And specifically, what we wanted to understand is how does it work in the context of the funding of science. So one problem of science is that the success rate of raising funds from science is not only very low, but it's also declining. Just by way of example, in the graph here, you should see the acceptance rate, the success rate of RO1 grants, which are the most common funding of NIH in the U.S., from 1997 to 2017. And you can see that they have declined from 30% to 19% in the spectrum of a few years. Okay, so what we want to see is whether crowdfunding has a different success rate. And on top of that, we are interested in understanding other problems of traditional fundraising sources. Like, for example, are there gender biases in crowdfunding or do we have problems similar to the traditional funding agencies that get criticized for being overly conservative when they fund science? So are the crowd risk-taking or risk-averse? So to investigate these issues, specifically in this talk, I will focus on answering six simple questions. So what does the crowd fund? Who seeks funding, so which scientists seek to raise funds from the crowd? What are the outcomes? What predicts the success in fundraising? Is the crowd gender equal? And is the crowd biased against risk-taking? Or is the crowd more willing to take risks? So to investigate this subject, we, together with a group of co-authors, looked at the largest platform that I have just shown you, which is experiment.com, and we collected a large amount of data to understand what was going on the platform. And we had a lot of coding, and specifically, we coded a great deal of information concerning the project, the kind of research that was presented, and also the kind of scientists that were trying to raise money. On top of that, we coded the kind of budget that they had and other relevant information. So the duration on average is between 30 and 45 days for a campaign. So in a maximum of 45 days, you know whether your project has been funded or not, which is quite remarkably short. And what we have seen is that there is a lot of work that the scientists have to do in order to raise funds. So they usually prepare a video. They oftentimes have people that endorse their project, like famous scientists or people that have a reputation in the realm of the science and technology community. And in some cases, they do list their prior publications. And in some cases, they also offer rewards, like if you bake my project, I, in exchange, let you visit my research lab, or I will thank you in the acknowledgments of my paper, etc. So it's quite interesting how a campaign is run for raising money in crowdfunding. So what we observe is also what the scientists are trying to seek. And basically what we can see is that the great majority of the money that is being sought for is for paying research equipment. This is the green, the large green slice of the pie that you can see. And the interesting thing is that there is very limited money from crowdfunding that is designed to go to paying overheads at the institutions or the department where the scientist is based. There is also little money being raised for the salary of the proponent. So usually the proponent doesn't ask money for themselves, but occasionally they do ask money for paying postdocs or other people involved in the project. So the first question, what does the crowd fund? Well, the first important thing to say is that the field distribution is very similar to that observed in traditional science funding. So the crowd and the kind of projects that we see there seem to be fairly similar to that observed in the traditional science funding. So there's a lot of life sciences and medicine, and there's also social sciences, engineering, etc. Quite interestingly, we also quoted whether the money was raised for projects of research aimed at understanding of phenomena or instead development or other more practical goals. And the great majority of the money is being raised for doing fundamental research. So who seeks funding? Well, we quoted the affiliation of the scientists that raised the money. And quite surprisingly, the vast majority of those are at university or higher education. Again, this is very similar to what happens in the realm of traditional science funding. You can think at crowdfunding as an alternative source to which people which are marginal or are only limitedly successful in other realms can resort to. But what we can observe is that the kind of institution that seek funding there are at least from the affiliation point of view, similar to those that raise funds in the traditional money-granting institutions. When we look at the position of the scientists that raise funding, it is extremely impressing to see that that 50% of the creators are students and postdocs, so very junior scholars. So many, about 30% are students below the PhD level, so either bachelor or master students. 25% are PhD students, 7% are postdocs, even though there are, of course, full associate and assistant professors seeking money for funding. So what are the outcomes? The first striking feature is that the average success rate was 48%, so more than double than what observed at traditional funding agencies. So this is a very interesting data. However, well, in total, the platform has raised $4.37 million in 2 years. However, The striking feature is also that these projects individually are extremely small. So we hoped that they were big in budgets, but instead they are very, very small. The medium project is only $3,103 overall, so extremely small projects. And the mean is 12,000. So there are projects which are very big, including one of $2.6 million, but that's more of an exception. On average, the projects are extremely, extremely small. So in terms of what predicts fundraising success, we have seen that quite surprisingly, junior scholars are more likely to get funded than professors or senior scholars, although they tend to raise similar amounts of money. They do not raise more or larger budgets on average compared to professors. in terms of campaign effort, the more effort the scientists place, the larger it is their success rate. And specifically, if they provide a video, if they have endorsement or provide rewards, or they show lab notes, then they raise more money. The next question is the crowd gender equal? And what we observe is that, first of all, there is a 40% of proponents which are female proponents, which is a comparatively large amount. And also we observe that female scholars are substantially more likely to succeed than their male colleagues, and that female scholars also raise comparatively more money or larger budgets than their male colleagues. Although surprising, this result is also consistent to other studies of crowdfunding, where we have seen that women tend to be more successful than men. Next question, is the crowd risk averse? Well, the crowd doesn't seem to be very interested at risk. What we have done is to look at whether pilot projects or projects presented as very preliminary are at a disadvantage compared to more advanced projects. And what we see is that they are not. And projects that list prior publication to show that the scientist is very competent in the area, they also are not likely to be more successful. And also projects that use a language underlying stronger uncertainty, they are also just equally likely to succeed than the others. So the hints are that the crowd doesn't seem to be very risk averse.
So just 2 minutes left, sorry, so that we have time for some questions at the end. If you could speed up, thanks.
Yeah, this is my conclusions, basically. So the crowdfunding of science promises a high success rate, 48%, and a fast turnout, 45 days, but it is also about very small amounts of money. So it, as such, it is unlikely to replace traditional science funding. So we can see that as more complementary than a substitute to traditional science funding. The research is not apparently dissimilar from traditionally funded research. Junior scholars and female investigators are favored. This is particularly different from the traditional science funding, and the crowd doesn't seem hostile to risk-taking and novelty. There are a number of open issues, like ethical issues or what kind of science is likely to be funded, but I think we can leave that to the Q&A. Thank you.
Thanks very much. Could our panelists come up, please? We're a little bit behind time. So any questions from the audience?
We've got all the ladies.
Yeah. I have a comment that I hope I can transform into a question while I'm speaking. The main reason for reduced acceptance rates for grant proposals is actually that we have more scientists and more proposals than ever before. This is so. It's that's the good news, of course. And why do we have that? That is another interesting question. Society's attention to science and universities have increased dramatically over the last 20 or 30 years. And that is for a number of reasons. Politicians and the society around us know that we live in a knowledge economy, and knowledge is power in this economy. But also, no, there's not a single ministry, at least in this country, that doesn't have a serious challenge on the long-term table. And whenever they're asked how they're going to solve this, they turn to us and say, science is going to, science, technology, academia. And you know, you can see that in the programs that are being put forward. You can see that in the programs addressing various aspects of these challenges. You can see that in the programs for the from the commission. And when you have these big challenges, it will be a big risk for society to bet on that it will be solved by each scientist walking into their office, closing their doors, and sit down and think about it. They want to create projects because many of these challenges are big, and they require a different type of working than many years ago. So what I'm saying here is this is a challenge for science and for academia. I mean, it's up to us to find good ways of responding to that. And we cannot just say, stop, this is not the way we want to work. It is important to find a balance between this type of project, focused collaborative work, and a type of more solitary thinking work. And we need to take that challenge. And we can start, of course, by throwing out email. It's not a technology, it's a pest. Thank you.
Is that a question?
No. I can comment on that. So there used to be more institutional funding that didn't require proposal writing, competitive proposal writing, but somehow the policy in the U.S. has moved to competitive proposal writing, and that has caused some of the issue, but not all of the issues, because once you get an award, then you have to deal with all the compliance issues, which are a nightmare too. But back to your comment about the scientists in the lab by themselves, we don't see that so much anymore, as you know. And the people I interviewed liked to collaborate. They felt it made them more productive, and they felt it enabled them to deal with more complex problems and work in more interesting problems. But it's just that one in five of all papers had a problem associated with it, mostly a contributorship problem, that either somebody was slow, or they weren't recognized when they should have been, or there was an honorary authorship. Those kinds of issues. And then 80% of the people we interviewed said there would be that sometime in their career they had the one big problem that was just a nightmare. Most of the problems are these little things about somebody being slow, but some of them are really big problems like I can't even talk about in a big audience. So all those things make it really a complex effort and not easily reduced to a toolkit solution.
So a little bit along those lines, and also picking up on something that Morten pointed out, right? You know, one of the things that scientists, I think, increasingly have to do is take the long view. And we see it, unfortunately, in politics, that there's a lot of incentive against taking the long view, right? I mean, I'm only seeing this as an outsider, but I can't help but notice that in the U.S., there seems to be sort of, you know, campaigning for elections all the time now, right? Mm-hmm. You come out of presidential elections, and 2 years later, you have midterm elections. So that basically means that 1 year after somebody has been elected, they're already into campaigning mode again. And I don't think that's just a Trump problem. That seems to be baked into the system. So once we democratize science funding and sort of, you know, get people into a situation where they have to compete in a very different way for it, I'm wondering what happens to the long view. I mean, how does somebody who wants to attack a problem that needs a 5 or 10 year runway, how do they actually sell this without having to spend half of their time justifying what they're doing all the time in various ways? I mean, at some point you just want people to get work done, right? So I wonder whether you can comment to this, because to me this seems to be something that with our current funding mechanisms might actually be borderline wrong, and I don't see how the kind of mechanisms that you're talking about would necessarily solve that problem. Maybe I missed something.
So I'll answer that, having worked in the Senate, very much so the science funding cycles were discordant with the scientists' needs. And particularly I might take Earth observation satellite systems. So in the U.S., the cycle would be like 2 years of funding when you really want to plan out 5 to 10 years. But that said, they could make decisions fast about missions, or relatively fast, compared to, say, in Europe, where you have it's consensus-based and it takes much longer to decide, but then you can count on that funding for longer periods. So I agree that in some sense in the U.S., that's to our disadvantage.
I would quickly say there's this view that competition leads to better anything. But for longer-term problems, there has been the rise of multidisciplinary, multi-institutional centers, which, like the engineering research centers in the U.S., which are 5 and 5, that gives you 10 years, that's 5 years and 5 years renewal, that gives you 10 years of funding, plus DARPA has a completely different funding approach, and you get very long-term funding, and the funding administrator works with you. So it's not always just these individual short-term projects, but I take your point that many of them are that way.
Yeah. So following up, Linda, you raised an issue which is more about these services and resources, which in this digital world increasingly we're going to need, and the business models for them, and how do we pay for them? So from your experience, do you have any comments on that?
Well, I'd like to comment on this idea of the scientists working alone in a laboratory and that not happening so much. The International Genetically Engineered Machine Competition actually builds collaboration as a cultural norm into the competition, and they also have built in, you know, you don't start with this is really cool technology and I want to do this science. You start with what is the world problem I want to solve. It can be a big world problem, it can be a small world problem, but it has to be a societally relevant problem. And you need to engage in the human practices portion of the competition. Have you talked to the people who you're trying to benefit with this technology? Have you talked to the experts in the field to say how the problems are currently being solved? How would your system impact these societies in ways that you could anticipate? What are some unanticipated or things that you might predict that you wouldn't want to have happen? So I think intervening in setting the cultural norms very early on to promote collaboration. The teams also have to do their own fundraising, so they get a very good idea as to what's involved in fundraising. And they seek things like the crowdfunding sources or tapping into the industry that their work might be relevant to, as well as their schools. Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
Okay, just, yep. One more question, final question then.
Have any of you seen any positive second order effects of, okay, something gets crowdfunded and now that helps it get funded from other sources?
I think that happens in a lot of situations. I had $2 million from Sloan Foundation and they actively encouraged me to leverage that to get additional funding. So I think that's best practice.
Is there any data on kind of larger scale?
Chiara, do you have any comments on that?
Yeah, I would like to address that question. Well, unfortunately, the evidence that we have about follow-on research at the moment is, to the best of my knowledge, not existent in the sense that we have never had a follow-on study about what happens next. But my co-authors and I have interviewed a couple of people in the U.S. that got funding from crowdfunding. And what we have learned is that these are not necessarily people that are unsuccessful at the traditional science agencies. In fact, some of them do have grants at NIH and NSF. The reason why they decided to go for crowdfunding at some point is that, the way they put it, is that some projects were not yet ready to raise money at those traditional sources. So they used the crowdfunding as a pilot project to see whether they had enough to justify a larger fundraising. So that's more the way they saw it, actually. But also they highlighted that the way in which you really succeed at getting money from the crowd is very different than the one that you use for traditional science funding. Especially, they had to be very good with Twitter, with Facebook. Basically, they had to make people interested and engaged at their work. And, of course, they felt that some eye-catching research was more likely to get funded. So, for example, a scientist we were talking to said that she was successful at raising money for a study about penguins, because apparently animal life, etc., it's more likely to engage the public compared to other topics. And so her time was really So she had this idea that number one, she was using that as a pilot project, and number two, not every kind of science was ideal for raising money from the crowd. So I think this is a concern, okay? And also the fact that a lot of time was taken to really popularize research topics, make them understandable, tweet about them, keep the public engaged, was also very time consuming. And so that wraps up to the first question about are we diverting scientists from doing science, or are we actually helping science? So that's, I think, an open question from that. And it's certainly awaiting more research, more data.
Okay, great. I'm sorry, we could go on forever,
but
we have to...
Can I ask one question?
Can we take it afterwards or in the last session somehow? Sure. We can see if we can bring it in. Okay, next panel.
Okay. Linda? Yes, let's go together. Just while Linda is getting mic'd up, we thought that, I mean, the data has been incredibly rich, broad, and deep, and I think we've been served with more information and insight than we can digest immediately. We'll probably know more about this tomorrow than today. But we thought it'd be interesting and useful to cap the day by inviting three discussants to reflect aloud on anything that's caught their attention during the day, to comment on unifying themes, elaborate any ideas that they've heard, points they think that the meeting may have raised, or offer examples illustrating some of what we've discussed from their own contexts. And we have, this will be quite a short session, maybe 25 minutes. We have three discussants, Anna Fellender, who we've met earlier in the day, the founder of the AI Sustainability Center, Linda Hardman, on my immediate left, who's a professor and manager of the research and strategy at the Centrum Wiskunde and Informatica in the Netherlands, and also a professor of multimedia discourse interaction at Utrecht University. And then Daniel Akinin. Daniel's working for Microsoft Technology Office on the long-term impact of technology on social and economic development. He's also a member of ISO's International Expert Group for Cloud Standards and vice chairman of the Swedish Computer Society. He's also a novelist as well. And so I think what we'll do is go for maybe 7 minutes each and then see also if anybody in the audience would like to bring up any themes reacting to what's said here. So I think I'll begin with Linda and go to Anna and then Daniel. Thank you.
Wasn't prepared for that. Okay. So one of the topics that was mentioned today was the need for computing professionals, basically qualified computer scientists, qualified machine learners. And my main pitch is how we address this. So I've been involved with Informatics Europe for a number of years. It's the Association of Computer Science Departments across Europe. And we've been looking at this for a number of years, how to address this. And I want to share some of our observations with you. So basically, at the moment, the number of students studying computer science and AI is completely inadequate to meet the demands of science and industry. We really want to keep the talented researchers in the ecosystem and also to ensure sufficient future graduates by employing them as young academics. But at the moment, we've seen today this whole problem with getting research funding, and there's basically insufficient research funding to attract and keep the academic staff in computer science. And if you can spell the word computer science, then you immediately get snapped up into industry and get employed there for more money than your professors earn. In Amsterdam and other places in the Netherlands, we've set up some data science center where we're stimulating an ecosystem of industry and academia, in some sense blurring the boundaries between the two. So we are more lenient, if you like, allowing professors to work a couple of days a week for company, which is possibly more usual in the United States. In the Netherlands, this is like, ooh, this is a weird thing to do. And where we are asking companies to invest directly into paying research staff. And enlightened companies understand that this is a good idea because it's helping the whole food chain, that you're getting the professors doing research who are then educating students who can then eventually work in their company. And in the short term, it allows them to get into contact with master students who can do projects in the company, or keeping closely in touch with the research projects of the PhD students. So I think what we need to do this in order to attract students to university is we need to expose them to computer science at high school. Now, for many real scientists in the room, physics, biology, chemistry are all taught at high school, certainly. Perhaps kids are exposed to it in primary schools, but computer science is really the baby of these other sciences. And I think we need to really address the bottleneck in the education chain, that we allow to teach our young children and our children in high schools in computer science and digital literacy. And these are two different things. I think we need both. And as we're doing this, we also need to remember that if you look at the most of the STEM population, but also the computer science population, it's very male-dominated. And we need to make sure that our curricula are also very accessible to the girls and women in our environment and other underrepresented minorities, but it's hard to get numbers on all of these things. So in addition to making sure we educate our population through primary school, secondary school, we're now living in an environment where the politicians and policymakers of today did not go through this training in high school or primary school. So they don't have these fundamental understanding of computer science or, say, machine learning. And this means that our current policymaking environment is not really able to take into account, okay, they need to talk to experts and think about how they can do things. So I think to enable politicians and policymakers of the future, we should really make sure that we have the digital literacy skills and the computer science skills taught at schools. And this requires a teaching of teachers. And unfortunately, this is another bottleneck, that very many teachers in high schools, if they can teach computer science, they can be employed in a company earning three times, four times the amount of money they earn teaching in high school. So this is something we have to address again in the across all the nations, the levels, to make sure that our teachers are actually willing to teach these courses. And again, perhaps we need to think out of the box and look at a more of an ecosystem state where we allow people from industry to get come into the schools and do the teaching. I don't know if you need to give them educational qualifications, but think of ways to actually bootstrap this whole process. Otherwise, it's going to be very, very tough. How many more minutes do I have?
Maybe one more minute.
One more minute. Thanks. Oh, well, I've got 20 more minutes worth of stuff here.
Okay. Approximately 1 minute.
Approximately 1 minute. So just to say there are a couple of recommendation documents published by Informatics Europe and ACM Europe jointly. One is on educational recommendations for digital literacy and computer science education at school level. And the other report is on automated decision making, so when computers decide. And this is a document which is intended to help technical people explain to non-technical people what it is about machine learning that makes it so powerful, and at the same time how we have to treat decisions made by machines that have been basically trained on data. And this isn't just a technical issue. It also includes ethical, legal, economic, society, and educational issues. So I'd like to leave it there.
Thanks very much, Linda. Anna, please.
Thank you. So it's been an honor to have been part of the discussion today, and I will reflect some of my thoughts. It's obvious that we are emerging into an area where mature technologies are being cross-fertilized, and this is where the exponential developing curve becomes vertical. So the speed is seductive here. And the question is, regarding AI, blockchain, virtual realities, crowd intelligence, for starter, crowd intelligence, enormous value, idle resources coming into motion, both when it comes to competence, things and services, artificial intelligence, reduced cost for making projections, blockchains having the ability to owning material, digital, and virtual realities making distance not apparent. So these gains are very obvious in business life. So when we translate this productivity gains that we hope to see soon into the area of science, is it more effective here? Are there the low hanging fruits more? That is the highly predictable routine tasks, are they more apparent in science? Or could there be that there are more market failures when this technology is applied to science? Could it be so that there are more ethical, negative, unintended pitfalls when it comes to science? So when it comes to the cross-fertilization and the discussion about regulatory frameworks, I would want to highlight something from my time being an expert in the Swedish government's taxi investigation, dealing with crowd intelligence when it comes to the taxi legitimations was put on, it was being challenged, I would say. So a middle hand or certification, and by this time the taxi legitimation that was Uber Pop in Sweden, whether we would say yes to earnings in crowd sharing shared driving. And we would say, well, the pitfalls of replacing this taxi legitimation with the peers, we would not do that because the pitfalls were too high or too costful, and there was too much at stake. So the same things goes for the certification when it comes to graduate diplomas, when it comes to validation of people in the gig economy. It goes sector-wise, I would say. So our suggestion in this taxi investigation was to look at each sector, and this would imply that the sector of science and how you would validate, how you would crowdsource, would be one sector of evaluating if the traditional validation, certification, diplomas was mature, or if the peers, the crowds, were mature enough to replace it. When it comes to health in Sweden, because this is where I want to follow a pattern, when it comes to healthcare in Sweden, we have this application called Kry and My Doctor. It's called when you get Skype calls and chats with a legitimized doctor in real time at extremely or at the same cost, that it's free for children in Sweden. And this is where I want to open for the market failure, because in the healthcare there is the demand for health is never ending. So the entry barriers to healthcare, since it's provided for free, is often based on the reluctance to enter the hospital due to the queuing system and such. Yet, referring to the tax, are you with me? Are you following my, okay. So back to the taxi investigation. What the result of the taxi investigation, that our traditional taxi companies, Taxi.com, they were using, they acknowledge the taxi drivers the clients for the taxi driver, thinking that the regulatory framework is it's overregulated, so there was a new innovation. Yet when the Uber Pop was banned, we saw that the traditional dinosaurs taxi companies applied the same technology as Uber Pop, but within the frames of the regulatory words. And we also in the taxi investigation pushed the regulation a little bit. So going back to the health application apps that we use, I foresee that they will enter a space where there could be also pitfalls, there could be overconsumption of health, there could be mistreatments, and there could be increased tax cost for the government due to this. Yet the fruitlessness is that the supplier of the traditional municipal owned care is now adopting the exact same technology. So by this innovation we're pushing the dinosaurs towards more innovative regulations. And this is something that the regulatory framework should accept and embrace. So that the front runners in technology should be working somewhat innovative under the regulatory frameworks pushing the dinosaurs forward. On the labor market, we have the Swedish Agency for Labor having explored a new innovative term called job tech, where we open up the databases and do matching. And this opens up to a new type of validation by the peers as well. So when it is tried under the public or the public agencies in cooperation with the tech actors, this is extremely fruitful and trustworthy. Going into the labor markets, because I want to comment 2 minutes, because I have 2 minutes.
Yes, go ahead. Approximately. Yes. Sorry.
I want to reflect on the labor market, because jobs, it's not jobs that will be lost, it's tasks that will be replaced. And back to the human and machine combination, this is where we do it the best. So where the competence must lie is to complement AI. So we need a lot of human workforce to explain AI, to train AI, and to sustain AI, and to do the ethical consideration and to adapt to new regulatory and framework and law system. So jobs will be lost. It's the routine or skills will be, tasks will be lost, and those tasks are routine, where it's a high predictability, but there will also be a lot of jobs coming into the labor market that is extending the skills. For example, a nurse. A nurse will be having a lot of value in his or her empathic skills, intuition, and experience, because there's a lot of course, value in AI doing diagnostic, yet a meeting with a patient is highly unpredictable. Now I'm going to do the final pitch or the final statement. When it comes to this regulatory pendulum that I described coming in earlier this morning, we should not wait, because then there will be accident pitfalls and then there will be a distrust to both technology and institutions. We should not do it too fast. That will hamper innovation and productivity. Instead, we should use standards. We should come together and test and pilot and try to formulate standards that, because the leading actors here is not science, it's not public agency, it's the companies. So the actors in business life must come together to create standards, upgrade them, and to transfer the knowledge to the politicians so that the regulatory framework can come in a bit later, but with more knowledge.
Okay. Thanks very much, Anna. Daniel, please.
So, last comment of the day, right? So, I'm also, so I'm working for Microsoft, but I'm also the co-founder of an organization called addai.org. And one of the main goals of this organization is trying to involve other disciplines into the discussion about AI. And with that, I mean the not usual suspects when it comes to AI. So I think we in this room is kind of the usual suspect to some extent. And what we are seeing is that it's the discussion of AI is really kind of a bubble to some extent. So what we have been doing is trying to talk to other disciplines and see what happens. And I would like to give you just two examples when we have been talking to other disciplines as well. For instance, like AI and animals. So I don't know if you read the report last week, which is called the Living Planet Report from WWF, the Worldwide Fund. So it was kind of shocking news if you read it. So the global wildlife population is actually down 60% since the last four decades. So it's down 60% in the last four decades. It's kind of shocking numbers. And the current rate is actually of animal extinction is 1,000 times larger than it was before humans was actually meddling in the system. So I think one of the questions that then could be asked, why don't people care? Why doesn't human care that animals is almost disappearing from the planet? And I think that in some sense, it is because humans, not all humans, but humans in general, they consider us to be superior to animals. So we are superior to animals, and our rights on this planet is also much stronger as a consequence. So what happens when technology, when we are starting to get relations to AI systems in a much, you know, in the next couple of years, I think there's going to be AI systems that you are going to create relations to. You are going to be friend. It's going to know a lot about you. And you are going to really consider yourself to some extent of maybe not being so superior anymore. So what will happen when that happens, for instance, in our relationship to animals? So when we are talking about, you know, to zoologists, etc., and introducing this, you're really seeing that the effects of, for instance, AI could dramatically also increase other areas as well. One other example is when we're talking to historians. So we should learn from history. Everybody is always saying you should learn from history. But do we really learn from history? I'm not so sure about that. I think that we are forgetting a lot of lessons that has, you know, lessons learned. So I think that if you go back 10 years, you are learning from that history. If you go even further, 50, 60 years back or 100 years back, you are not really learning from history anymore. And why is that? I think one of the reasons is because it's so much information. So it's really tough to stay in touch with history. So if you're doing, for instance, law research, we are talking to law professors, what they're basically saying, we have so much data, we have libraries with so many books, we don't even remember what was happening in the 50s anymore, so we can't really remember this. So what if we are having AI systems in the future that gets us more connected to history? So it could really, when you are, you know, introducing and you want to do something, the AI system could help you say, this has been actually discussed 60 years ago. Mm. And you could get some input from this. And you could get a lot of information about this place, for instance. So I think it could make people actually more, less historyless, if you know what I mean. So that's also an interesting thought that I think AI systems, etc., could impact. So what my main comment, and I have other comments, but maybe I should stop there. So my main comment here is really, I think it's interesting to really involve other disciplines as well, because when it comes to systems like AI, it is really impacting all of the disciplines.
I'll just make a couple of sentences and then we must go. I think just your Ad AI initiative reminds me of the very large MIT initiative that was announced a couple of weeks ago with the sum of $1 billion, even I think was in the air, had the intention of making machine learning and AI more accessible to a very wide spectrum of professions beyond computer scientists and data scientists and so on. And I really enjoy your cultural, historical, sociological observations about how AI may affect our ultimate relationship with the planet and even with our own historical selves. And there's a beautiful TED talk given by a chap called Guy Hoffman, where he's tried to code distinctive features, idiosyncratic features of human movement, and put that into a desktop lamp. And you actually see the feeling of a relationship being developed with a desktop lamp as it looks at the writer at the desktop. So anyway, I think we will easily anthropomorphize our AI counterparts quite soon. So with that, then we have a dinner at 7 o'clock, and this is just up the street, and so the easiest way logistically for us all to get there on time. And this will begin with a speech which I'm very much looking forward to that Bruce Damon will give, a continuation of his opening this morning. But so we don't get lost here, I think it would be best to reconvene here back at the entrance in the lobby at about 5 to 7. So the hotel's only a few minutes away. We can go maybe get a change of clothing and or just relax for a moment and then come back and be here at, say, 5 to 7, and we'll walk up to the restaurant as a group. So thank you very much. Look forward to your participation tomorrow. Bye-bye.